where are you going? And I said, well, we're going to such and such a town. He said, we haven't been through there yet. I said, well, that's where we're told to go. So, well, go ahead. I said, we haven't been through there. So we
I'm Jeff Wells, and you're listening to Walk Among Heroes, a podcast dedicated to honoring the brave men and women who allow us to enjoy the greatest privilege in the world, freedom. Each Tuesday, I'll sit down with an incredible military hero. We will listen to unedited, authentic stories in their own voices, in their own words. We will hear incredible military stories from some of the greatest heroes to ever walk the face of this earth. And who knows, we may even learn a few of their secret life lessons along the way. Although none of us can begin to imagine what they've seen, heard, and experienced, during our time together, I'll do my very best to take us all for a walk among heroes. Here we go. I'm Jeff Wells, and you're listening to Walk Among Heroes podcast episode 29B, which is the conclusion of our two-part conversation with Mr. Morris Buck Buckman, as well as my good friend Kyle. I want to thank you all so much for coming back and joining us. This episode is going to be a little bit different. We talked about most of Mr. Buckman's World War II service as part of the 87th Infantry Division, 345th Infantry Regiment in part one of our conversation. So part two is going to focus more on his service after the military, his advice, you know, things that he'd like to offer for younger folks, as well as just a conversation between us about some of my military service in Iraq, which I usually don't like to talk about or at least publish much on the podcast. But Mr. Buckman asked, and I tried to answer his questions. So if you have any interest in that, we talk about that quite a bit here in part two. And so you came back to the United States, went to Fort Benning to train for Japan. And was that where you were at when Japan finally surrendered?
Yeah, that's when the bomb was dropped. And we were, as I recall, again, I'm back in the hospital. They sent me back to the hospital. But I missed out on a lot. So, in fact, in the company picture we took when they took everybody's company pictures for the book, I'm not in it because I'm in the hospital. As I recall, we were about a week from being ready to go. Ship start heading for the West Coast.
You definitely wouldn't be here today if you had been part of that deal.
That would have been murdered. Yeah, they wouldn't have given up.
So the war is over. How long before you were able to go home? Did they start discharging everybody immediately? Or
I was a special deal because I was in the hospital, but they had a doctors had me in and showed me the x-ray of my leg. And it's the right leg, but the middle of the ankle, the whole series of bones,
right.
And they're all pieces. And so I asked him, how come previous pictures of that didn't show all the pieces? Well, it had to be the angle they took it. But anyway, so they decided to discharge me. And for some reason or another, again, I don't know, but they were going to make a line of duty note. And I told him, well, this happened on a OCS problem. I jumped over this ditch. Well, normally, what do you know? So I get to the hearing. They gave you, when you ushered out, they gave me a hearing before majors and colonels. Mm-hmm. I think there were six of them. And during the questioning, one of the majors asked me, are you satisfied with being discharged? I said, no. I said, this line of duty, no. It happened to me while I was on duty. And you could tell he tucked this over before, because the other way he called me, stopped the other way. And so I ended up being ushered out as on disability, 40% disability.
Wow.
So I didn't go out with the whole gang. I never backed with my outfit again, you know, in the hospital, which I regret. You know, you build a lot of friendships.
You persevered through quite a bit, though. I really admire you for many reasons, but for, you know, when you first found out about your ankle or your foot, and you know, you probably could have just gotten out of everything at that point, right? But you wanted to go back to your unit.
I could have gone to Lunar Duty or gone home.
Yeah.
Too, yeah.
Not everybody would have done that.
Yeah, one of them I always wondered about, my Captain Christian, he was the captain when I first joined the 87th. Great guy. We got over to, when we went to the Bulge, all at once he disappeared. You know, Captain Dunn, who was my one I reported to, Captain Dunn was in charge of the whole motor pool. I asked Captain Dunn, what happened to Captain Christian? I can't talk about it. Well, you didn't tell me. We're friends. No, I can't talk about it. I think he and had Captain Dunn both had great, well, I knew them when back in Fort Jackson. They had an apartment together and I'd visit with them. So I knew their wives. And I think he was probably not a combat soldier. He was, the thing about his wife and family and worrying about things, I think he cracked up and asked to be sent out. Off and water. You know, I never saw him again. I saw Captain Gunn then. Again, he was in Altoona, Pennsylvania. I was in Buffalo, New York, and they had a boxcar that got banged up in the AMP in Altoona, where he was the warehouse manager. So I said, let me go down there and check on this thing. So I want to talk to see Captain Dunn. So I went down and saw Captain Dunn and his wife, Sarah, and had dinner with him. Kind of relived a little bit. But I never asked again about Captain Christian because he didn't want to talk about it. He knew, but he didn't want to talk about it.
It happens. It happens. Yeah.
And again, I don't know. I'm just assuming.
I think there's a point, too, where Kyle and I were talking about this earlier, but I think there's a point where, you know, what we were talking about earlier, war is supposed to be fought by the young.
Yeah. You've got to be dumb.
You have to be young and dumb. And once you reach a certain point in life.
Yeah. And I think that in this case, he's older and smarter.
I have a mutual friend. We were together over in Iraq, and he's fearless, you know, warrior. Killed every enemy that within, you know. And then came back a couple years later, redeployed again.
Oh, yeah.
And finally, it got four or five deployments down, and I remember sitting with him and talking to him, and he broke down into tears, scared to death to go back.
Yeah.
And this is probably one of the toughest warriors I've ever seen.
I've been there.
And it just shows that all of a sudden you have different considerations. You now have a family. You have, mm-hmm. you've learned throughout life. You understand how dangerous it really is, and you start thinking about it and second guessing it. Your tolerance, everything's changed. But that kind of stuff happens, and sometimes you can't entirely blame people for that. You know, it's.
We are. That's it.
So what did you do after you were discharged? You got to go home.
Yeah, I got married when we got back from Europe. I gave us a month leave, and I got married, and so I went back to school.
Okay.
And I lacked.
Back to Kansas.
Kansas State, yeah. I lacked one. I worked all the time. I was going to school the first 3 years, so I carried light load. I was a whole semester short. So I went back and finished, and then I took a little master's work, and it wasn't working out. So then I went to work for General Mills and stayed with them for 30-some years as a miller, flour miller.
Interesting.
I say flour miller. The only time I was really a flour miller was 3 years I sure served as a shift miller. I'm in charge of the mill on the shift, and that's when you're really a miller then. But the rest of the time, I'm engineering or something. The milling school had three divisions, engineering, administration, and chemistry. And so I was in the engineering part.
Gotcha.
And so I was what I call a half-assed engineer. We took a lot of engineering courses, not all of them, but most of them.
And this was in Kansas you worked?
Well, I started in Kansas City. I was taking my master's work, and my project, my thesis thing wasn't going to turn out as use of wetting agents and tempering wheat, and everything used was poisonous, so it wasn't much use. But I had one thing that you could use as wetting agent that wasn't poisonous, but people wouldn't want to eat something new that you use as wetting agent. But anyway, when in the milling of wheat, you have to add water to bring it up to 16% moisture. So you just add water and let it sit for about 8 hours, and then you mill it. Anyway, by use of wetting agents, the theory was you could put it on there an hour later and mill it. But anyway, it was going no place, so I decided I'm going to go work. And I went to Kansas City and applied for a job. Back when I was first went to school, the reason I took milling too, if you took milling and graduated, you'd have at least three job offers. Engineers are getting out of school and not getting anything. And so this is a big draw back in the Depression. You had a job offer, and you got out of school, a big deal.
It's a big deal.
So I applied on my own. I didn't wait for anybody to offer me a job. I went to General Mills and applied for a job, and they hired me, and I went to work for them. Ended up, I was in Kansas City for a few years, and I went to Buffalo, New York, Buffalo, New York was the world's largest mill.
Interesting.
And it was one of those things like, you want to say that he was a miller, the world's largest mill. So, but anyway, I ended up going through all the jobs up there, and ended up in charge of all the mills for General Mills when I retired.
At what point did you come down here to Texas?
Brent was in Austin. Other son Mike was in Dallas.
So two boys, two sons.
Yeah, so we're going to get between them. We're getting Slato. Slato's up to out here. Now I'm between two boys. Oh,
right.
Great. Sooner we get settled, they take off.
So you moved to Slato.
Oh, yeah. So
Bell County, right? Bell County, Texas.
Yeah, right.
Not far from Fort Hood.
Yeah, Bell County. But kind of odd how we got there. We were in Minneapolis. And my wife got involved in so-called dance club. They were originally started out to learn how to dance. They were going to hire a group of them. Well, after two sessions, they got to decide they were an eating club better
social
than eating,
club.
A dance club. So they turned into eating club. But anyway, when we moved to Minneapolis, when I was in charge of the mills, she got involved with somebody that was in this dance club. So we ended up, and the guy that had been in the dance club, he moved to Little Rock. When he retired, he went to play golf down there in Little Rock. And then all the people in the group decided they didn't like Little Rock, so they decided they had, seven of them organized. They're all going out and check a golfing community, come back and prepare notes, and we'll all go there.
I'll be down.
So they all spread out and went in several different directions. They all come back and prepared notes, and they all went back to work. the group crap fell apart.
Everybody went to their place.
Yeah, they all went back to work. So anyway, this guy's in Slato that I had met one time when he came back for a big reunion of this dance club. We were up in northern Michigan, Minnesota, someplace at some lake, and I met him. And so he was in Slato. So when the son was in UT, so sometime on the way back, so we'll call him up, we'll stop and I'll see what he's got to offer and where he's at. So call him up. Yeah, I'll show you around. So we stop on the way back to Minneapolis. And he takes us all around the golf course, and we liked what we saw. So we ended up in Sligo when I retired. Well, we did spend one winter in Lakeway in Austin there to for his son's wife and having babies, so my wife had been to help with her. But outside of that, we had never been to, well, I'd been in Dallas. I was signed to a refrigerated food plant in Dallas at one time. So I knew a little bit about Texas, but we spent about a year and a half in Dallas at this refrigerated food plant.
And you worked for General Mills your whole...
Yeah, all the time, yeah.
So Salado, and then...
Yeah, 35 years in Salado, because when I came here, I was losing my eyesight. Otherwise, I'd have stayed in Salado, but it was getting so I couldn't repair things. And,
yeah.
So my son in Scottsdale, he had arranged, checked out a place out there. He wanted me to come there. And then Brent's wife, Tammy, she checked out some here, and she showed me this in here, and I like to hear it, so I, you don't need to show me anymore, so I'll stay here. So that's why I ended up here.
It's a wonderful place.
Well, the pandemic, of course, screwed everybody up. This is bad here because you couldn't get out. If you went out, you got locked down for 14 days, and so nobody went out, but it's going to open it up a little bit now.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
I have two questions for you. And I've been sitting here quiet as can be.
You have.
I haven't been this quiet my whole life.
It's true.
Well, you know, at the Bulge, I always thought it was kind of interesting because D-Day, a lot of it was based on the weather. Mm-hmm. And the Bulge also. And it always made me wonder, did you guys, the people are there, you knew you were waiting for those clouds to break. And when those planes started coming over and dropping on those columns,
now the plane, when we were going down the Saar Valley, was taking pictures. He wasn't shooting at anybody. He was just taking pictures.
Oh, no, sir. I meant at the Bulge. Once the cloud cover and the Air Force was able to do its number on the Germans trying to come through the Bulge, was that a... once those clouds broke open, am I mistaken?
No, what Kyle's referring to is on, you know, when, and as Patton was trying to get you guys over there, you know, to help out, the clouds were preventing the
no air cover. Yeah.
Yeah. No air cover. And then eventually, I think right around Christmas or sometime around Christmas there, the planes were finally able to fly.
Yeah. So in my imagination, it's always been like, God just opened up, and y'all, and I imagine they could hear those bombs in the distance, giving it to them. I was just curious if.
I don't recall we ever really. Of course,
I'm not sure you'd be aware of that. As a foot soldier, or yeah. as a
yeah, only foot thing we could hear them going overhead. Flotillas, because I always remember amazed at how many was going over after when it opened up.
Yeah.
Now when we first went in the Bulge, you didn't hear anything going on up there.
Yeah.
And after it opened up, here come these waves of bombers.
Yeah.
And I always remember the first wave to come over and the contrails, you know, I don't know how many be in the wing, but probably 20. This, all the contrails, the person would come over in pattern. They always had to stand this pattern. The contrails would move out for the next wave to come across. And the cold sky would be cloudy with just the contrails blocking the sun.
Yeah.
That's how many were coming over.
You probably, I'm just guessing, but you probably, the Battle of the Bulge is a romantic concept. Now it's called the Battle of the Bulge. At that time, you were sent to a location X with the intention of fighting the Germans. You probably didn't even know at that time that this massive German attack that spanned hundreds of miles was happening, did you? Or were you aware that the massive Bulge was taking place.
Yeah, we pretty well were. They had the Stars and Stripes newspaper come out once.
Oh, I see.
They kind of lay it out pretty good for you.
So you knew what was happening.
Yeah.
Strategically.
With between the flotillas of bombers going across, and I guess there, I don't know, I suppose it'd be a thousand probably total, but they weren't dropping anything close to us. It's all over past us. But we'd hear the B-2s and the what we called the Maytags going across at night.
Yeah. Those are the German rockets.
Yeah, the rocket deals. And I still don't know about this Maytag. It's like a Maytag. It sounds just like a Maytag horse machine, a motorized deal. And you hear them going over at night, and then you hear the B-2s whistling. But you didn't, of course, you never, they're bombing
so fast.
London or someplace.
Yeah.
I was always amazed at the number of planes would be, when they started bombing, the number of planes that would be coming over this kept coming.
I bet the Germans were wondering about it.
Yeah, I bet so too, yeah.
You always see the, what they call Patton's Prayer. Have you ever read that? When he was on his way, to the Bulge, they were trying to get there as quickly as possible. And he stopped in some town in the middle of Belgium, in this chapel. And he went in and he said this prayer, which has been documented. Who knows if it's been embellished over the years, but the gist of it is, Lord, something like, get those GD. He said, if you just please clear the skies so I can get my GD planes in the air.
Right.
He said, I will keep your bookkeepers busy counting the Germans for as long as you can possibly imagine. That was I'll send it to you. That was the gist of it.
Yeah.
But yes, that was as soon as the skies cleared, that was definitely a turning point
I have one more question. Is there anything that you carried with you from the start to the end of the war that you brought back with you that was your that you kept with you?
No,
nothing.
No good luck, please.
Okay. Yeah.
No, I didn't.
Did you know your wife to be? Did you correspond during the war? Did you write each other?
Yeah, very little though. It's amazing. You had too much to do. You,
sure.
It was easy. Something easy to put off too. I think if you had time and you'd probably figure out something else to do, but you corresponded,
I remember I found my grandparents, my grandpa had met my grandma right before he deployed. So he had gone through all of his training and then sent home for a couple weeks leave, and then they had to report back and then they deployed. And he met my grandma during that time home, that 2 weeks home, and he met her, he was maybe like 19 and she was 17 or something like that. So he had graduated high school and she was still in high school. And so he was driving down the road and she and her friend were walking home from school, and it was raining. It started raining. So he pulled over and offered to give them a ride home. And so they their entire relationship formed, progressed and developed while he was over there. And it was done through letters.
Wow.
It was done through letters. And I have a few. I found a few of them. But it was so interesting to see, see the letter of my grandma writing my grandpa. She had met his family back home for the first time while he was over there, and to see them describe that.
Mm-hmm.
I love reading. I know you were limited in what you could write. You couldn't, because they would screen, what you could write.
Yeah.
They would look at it. But it's so interesting to me reading all those letters. When you have somebody in combat and somebody back home and you're trying to, make them feel okay. And it's just very, very, what about that 45? You carried that 45.
I carried that 45 all the time. And my grandson's got it now.
So you still have it in the family?
Yeah, I still got it.
Well, you told me you didn't, that's it.
That's it.
You can't say that was your lucky charm.
Yeah, well, I think maybe so, yeah.
And I like the fact that you still don't know how the hell you got it or why you got it. That's an interesting question.
Yeah.
That's amazing. That's I was going to ask you too, you know, as you look back on everything, you know, now, and you sort of look back on your time in the service, what advice would you have for youngsters that are maybe in the military today that are just getting started or maybe thinking about going in the military? What would you tell those young folks today?
You know, yes, I don't know. The patriotism is not there anymore. No. I think you're probably the last one that's going to be. And again, I think I find myself wondering if I'd volunteer next time too. Because you wonder about. I got a mental block about being a policeman of the world. I just don't think we should. Too many of the young guys like yourself are used serving Iraq and all that, Iran. Is losing all these young guys being policemen is not. I got a mental block on it.
You'd have a hard time finding anybody to argue with you on that, you know, in the military or otherwise.
You look back at all the soldiers we lose in Iraq, Vietnam, Korea. If they won't defend themselves first, why should we? I don't know.
Well, World War II was the last, you know, I guess you could call it the last honorable, good cause, you know, I have to be careful how I say this, but it was the last truly justified, where nobody in the world questions. We always have a justification, but nobody in the world questions.
Not when you're attacked.
Why we were involved in World War II. Everybody understands that the stakes were the future of the world. And if had we not gotten involved, Britain was down to its, we had nothing left.
Yeah.
And the other allied countries were just getting overwhelmed. And I think that when you look at all the other wars since then, you know, I always try to focus on pull out the politics and pull out that kind of stuff and focus on the sacrifices of the folks who were actually there. But when you look at the politics behind it, you're right. There were a lot of lives lost that shouldn't have been.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. So what would you tell the youngsters what would you say to them, and maybe not even in the military, just advice for life in general?
Well, I think, again, it's a situation. Now, if, like in Vietnam, at the time that the ones that go to Canada and skip it, I had no use for them.
Yeah.
If I was a young guy, I might go to Canada myself. I don't know. I'm talking about not like a World War II type thing.
No, I understand.
It's just when you're sent over to be a policeman of the world and getting killed.
Right.
I don't know. I find myself hating myself for being, I might say, non-patriotic, but you don't sometimes want to be, you don't want to be too stupid either.
Well, I think you are being patriotic because you're trying to protect our young men and women that are putting their lives at stake because you've been there yourself. You know, these are human lives that are being deployed. And when you do that, you better, you know, take every other precaution and every other means first before you put lives in jeopardy. And
now you were a volunteer though, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. They did not do a draft for, I went through ROTC as well.
Oh, did you?
And I was a lieutenant as well, over there. And I was a combat engineer. But at the time when we, do you know what a Bradley fighting vehicle is? Bradley is like a tank, you know, it's like a tank, but it doesn't have the same size weaponry as a tank, but it's Anyway, at the time, we were one of two combat engineer battalions in the entire Army that had Bradleys. It was an experimental thing that we were, you know, combat engineers are normally building bridges and blowing up minefields, and they're with the infantry and they attach themselves to the infantry. So when we deployed to Iraq, we thought that we were going to be augmenting an infantry unit and that we would be doing things like demolitions and, you know, stuff that engineers normally do. And so we got to Kuwait, and then probably a week or so before we did our training, last final training, 20, 30 days in the desert, this and that. And about a week before we were going to leave to convoy up to Baghdad, my battalion commander brought us in and said, our missions changed completely. And we all of a sudden transitioned from augmenting infantry. Baghdad was such a big city, there just wasn't enough infantry units to cover the city. So they ended up making my battalion, which is the 91st Engineer Battalion, a task force. So they gave us tanks, they gave us aviation, they gave us everything. And so we ended up being our own task force within Baghdad. And then it ended up being the worst area in Baghdad, actually one of the worst areas in Iraq at that time. And so then they augmented us with more firepower.
Worst areas in the combat part, or just the
combat part? Yeah. Worst. It was, if you look at Baghdad as a city, you know, you look at Baghdad, there's one major north-south interstate that goes through all of Iraq, and there's one major east-west interstate that goes through Iraq, and they intersect in one of these big cloverleaf intersections like you would see in Austin, downtown Austin. And that northwest sector of Baghdad, that used to be Saddam's old farmland. And so everybody in that area was very loyal to Saddam. And so when we came in, the Al-Qaeda folks came in and they took that entire area and they turned it into a breeding ground or training ground for Al-Qaeda Iraq. And so anytime any of the Al-Qaeda folks came in from Syria or Fallujah, they would come into our area. So, and then on top of that, you had the that intersection, that cloverleaf intersection, which was the most heavily attacked intersection in Iraq, because any single supply convoy that came through there, you know, they had to go through that one intersection. And so anyway, that was, you know, it's like you said, we did some, you know, security, some police work and a little of everything, but that was my background, you know, in terms of what I did and how I did. But I was an ROTC guy. I went to the University of Florida. I grew up in Florida and went that route to become an officer. And I did 4 years active duty and 4 years in the reserves.
You know, of course, I just reading about Iraq. Yeah, I kind of got the impression you hate to get in the vehicle because you're always hitting a mine or something. They sent them off by telephones and so forth.
They were.
I think you'd be sweating it out every time you got in a vehicle.
You're actually over there, you're safer on foot, we learned. Yeah. You know, and because when you're in a vehicle, they track you. You know, they have these guys everywhere that track exactly where you're at. And so when you're in a vehicle, you're hard to miss. But when you're on foot, you can blend in, especially at night.
Yeah.
You know, and so for us, like right now, whenever the sun goes down, you know, a lot of people, they don't like the darkness or whatever. It brings me a very comforting feeling because every day we would go through hell and back, and then all of a sudden the sun would go down, and then now we had the advantage.
Yeah.
You know, and it was like, so now even today when I see the sun go down and it's night, it's just very comfortable. You know, I like it. But once the sun went down, then all of a sudden, the problem with Baghdad, you know, it's a city the size of Austin geographically, but there are 7 million people. So they're packed like rats, one on top of another. And so it's very difficult to figure out who's friends, who's enemies, probably like Vietnam, but in different situations, jungle. You don't know who's your friend, who's your enemy. People are packed one on top of another. You're dealing with an enemy that doesn't care about killing civilians, but we do care about killing civilians. Yeah. So you're dealing with different value systems, you know. In World War II, at least from what I understand or have heard, you know, the Germans were professional soldiers for the most part. You know, the fanatics, the Nazis were fanatics, but the actual Wehrmacht, you know, the German soldiers were professional. These folks over here that, you know, that we're dealing with, if they catch you, they'll cut your head off, put it on TV, you know. So it's a different type deal. But, you know, the most, to your point about being a police force, you know, my soldiers would ask me all the time, sir, why are we here? What are we doing here? Why are we here? You know, we don't understand. What's our mission? What's our purpose? You know, they would ask that a lot, and it's hard to answer.
Yeah.
You know, and if you can't answer that, your answer was, well, we're saving the world. You know, I mean, that's very clear. You know, we're saving the world. For us, you know, it wasn't quite so clear. Vietnam was the same way. You know, you look at some of the major battles of Vietnam, Hamburger Hill and some of those other battles that, you know, hundreds and thousands of lives sacrificed. And then the next week we leave and give it right back to the North Vietnamese. Similar, and, you know, to me, war by definition is we're here, they're here, and our job is to take that.
Yeah.
That's war. You're taking land, territory, right? That was World War II.
Yeah.
You're here in France, we're going to Germany, and we're not going to stop until we take Germany. It's very simple, you know, but when you get into a situation where you're just dropped in the middle of somewhere, and you have no clear territory, you're just simply supposed to stay where you're at and fend everybody off that's attacking you. That's not a clear mission.
Yeah,
and that's not war either.
Yeah.
It's combat, but it's not war.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, war has a very clear purpose and vision. So, you know, yes, that was a little bit, you know, what we dealt with. Still, the guys still dealing with it today.
Yeah.
I talked to the other day, a group, they're in Syria, and they're an air defense unit in Syria, a little corner of Syria, and every day they're getting attacked by, you know, rockets and everything. Come for what purpose? What good can we possibly do in Syria?
Yeah.
What value? What? I don't even know what the mission is, to be honest with you, in Syria.
Yeah.
So this whole counterterrorism deal, it's an intelligence war, you know, and the key to winning that war is figure out where they eat, figure out where they sleep, figure out where they pray, go kill them, you know, that can be done with drones and special operations and things like that. It doesn't necessarily require boots on the ground. I don't think. Boots on the ground are for real war, which is taking territory. Land. But, you know, you probably didn't even understand at the time what you were, the significance of what you were doing. You know, I guess if you're reading the paper, you may have understood a little bit. And how old were you, like in 1944,
1945? I was born in 20, so
so you were 24, 25.
20, yeah. I was, got out when I was 25, and went in 22, so I was 3 years in there.
Have you ever been to any of the reunions for your division?
The colonel of the 3rd Battalion tried to get, I don't know, probably 3 or 4 years after the war, he tried to round up alumni or association, and he was the worst one to pick to try to round them up because nobody liked him. So they just, I know, I felt like telling what I thought, but I didn't, but... he was one of those guys that sacrificed you to get his own advantage. And I always remember, of course, I, as a regimental transportation officer in Fort Jackson, of course, I had the motor pool. And so one day, as 3rd Battalion commander, he's going to inspect the motor pool. And outside of having no caps for the tire stem, ones you put on top there, because everybody's stealing them. But there wasn't anything wrong with the motor pool. Everything shined up. Of course, you'd be ready for them. So he gets all through. Well, he didn't know what he's looking for. But he gets all through. He says, "But to that guy, I gotta have something. Mark out here." And so, Major Moran, the only thing I can tell you is that everything's perfect except in the back of the Jeep, you have a little container with the chains in it. And you never dig those out unless you had to. Well, they get a little rusty. So I said, he was a major at the time. Major Moran, I said, the only thing I'd say is the chains are rusty, but that's standard. Oh, he wasn't a fit. He just raved him. And he said, "You made it." Of course, I ended up the fall guy. So I had to go take all these Jeeps out and drag them through the sand and get them shined up so they shine. What good it does to have a chain shine, I never understood. But anyway, I always got mad at him about that. He used me as a tool to raise all this hell, and now I got to do all the work.
The first reunion we did, we had a similar deal where they decided to do a reunion, and the person that organized it, of course, we were at that time there were no women in the combat arms, so infantry, artillery, combat engineers, you know, no women. But we had a maintenance officer who was a female, Captain Toten. She's a great gal, Kathleen. I'm friends with her today, but nobody liked her. Back then, nobody liked her at all because anytime you had a vehicle breakdown, you had to go to her for parts.
Sure.
She'd take her time, and there's no sense of urgency, and she'd give you the runaround, and so nobody could stand her. So we organized a reunion. She volunteered to organize the thing, and she calls me one day, and she said, "Jeff, would you mind sending an email out to all the guys because nobody is responding to me?" And I said, "Well, Kathleen," I said, "it's because nobody liked you." "What do you mean?" I said, "You understand that we would get our asses chewed every single day when our vehicles weren't ready to go. And the only way we could get the vehicles ready to go was to get parts. And so all the guys would come to you to get parts and you'd give them a hard time getting parts. So nobody likes you." I said, "I like you. I think you're a nice person." But I said, "They don't like you." And she says, "Oh, okay. Could you send an email out?" I said, "Yes." And so we sent an email out. But similar deal. Yeah.
Did you have the reunion?
We did. We did. We had our first reunion a couple years ago in San Antonio. Our guys live all over the place. I deployed from Fort Hood, so just right up the road. But now everybody lives everywhere else, but they're all over the place. But we have a problem where, unfortunately, you know, fairly often we lose guys still through suicide. Nearly every year. And so we realize that the best way to try to help that is to communicate. Because most of the time, that seems to happen when people are alone.
Yeah.
You know, if you lose track of people or people are left alone, it tends to happen. So we thought by doing a reunion, we could try to keep our eyes on people and get together. And we have a ranch. A guy that I know has a real pretty ranch out in Seguin, Texas, which is kind of east of San Antonio. And it's out on Lake McQueenie out that way. And just beautiful, very peaceful. And so all we did was just get everybody out there and spend the day. And I had a little band come out, play some music, and, you know, we just talked basically all day, and families came out and met each other and played games and all that. And
what kind of turnout did you get? 5%?
No, I would say probably 15-20%. We did, but it's more recent, you know, we take a lot of pride. As far as I know, there has never been another combat engineer battalion that did what we did, where they converted us into a task force and put us into that. As far as I know, that's never happened before. So there's a lot of pride, you know, by the guys and what we did and everything. But anyway, we've done a decent job. And the stuff like Facebook and social media today on the computer, the internet, it's easier to keep track of people, you know, find people. I remember when I first, that was really the thing that caused me to go on Facebook was, to catch up with the guys, see what the guys were doing. That we had served. Because when I came back, I wanted nothing to do with anything to do with the military or the Army or anytime I saw some of those guys, I would have certain memories that weren't always good. So, but that goes away over time. Then you develop a deep affection for them and want to make sure that they're taken care of and, you know, that sort of thing. So,
did you ever get in the military?
No.
Good.
No.
You were born to be in the military, though. If reincarnation was such a thing, you were probably in World War II in a previous life, I would imagine.
I'll stick to the acting.
So you're like my boy. They avoided the whole thing, which is good, I think.
Yeah. No, I've always had a... I don't know why, but I always had a deep interest. I was born in 65, and I was a late mistake in my family. My father was born in 23.
Yeah,
So I had a connection to that period through them. But it was when I was a little kid in Georgia, and on the PBS station, the first time when I saw the introduction to World at War. That was narrated by Laurence Olivier.
Yeah.
And then I have all those Time Life books. And I read Rise and Fall of the Third Reich when I was a little kid. And I just got sucked into, I was just always interested in that. Yeah. So this is a great joy to be here and to hear you speak about this. And as well as my grandma, Elsie Meyer, her brother Paul, from what I recall, she was one of nine kids. He also served at the Bulge in some capacity. Unfortunately, I don't know what that capacity was. So this is
I've blown away by how many, you know, families that, like yourself, that you served in the war, but the families never ask. Like in my case, you know, I never asked, never really talked to my grandpa much about it. But, and in some cases, you know, it's probably harder to open up to your family than it is to.
Yeah, I don't know. Of course, as a kid, you aren't interested in that stuff. I know my grandfather, he homesteaded in Kansas. He and his brother rode a horses from Michigan out to Nova, Kansas to homestead. And often look back at, man, I wish I'd ask him all about how you cross the rivers and how do you do this and how long did it take you to drive a horse for that far?
You don't think about it.
No.
You just don't think about it.
He was not a talker anyway. I'd probably have to dig it out
of him. Oh, my gosh. Well, it's been just an honor, and I thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. And
that concludes episode 28A, which is part one of our two-part interview series with Mr. Paul Frederick, United States Marine Corps, current resident of Lexington, Kentucky. Just an amazing man and a true honor to meet him and talk to him about his amazing story. And, you know, the one thing that strikes me about Mr. Frederick, obviously his relationship with his wife for many, many years, Myrtle, which he talks about over and over again. And you just see in talking to all of these incredible heroes, you hear about their rock solid relationships throughout their lives back home with their significant others. And this is no exception, listening to Mr. Frederick talk about Myrtle and the life that they had together. And that was actually featured in the song that Jim Collins had written. And then just secondly, if you go back and you listen to all of our guests that we've had so far that have been involved in Iwo Jima, including Woody Williams himself, who was awarded the Medal of Honor for his actions on Iwo Jima. If you go back and you listen to their stories, many of them had significant periods of time where they just can't remember. They blacked out. They can't remember. It all blended together. And I know that was a long time ago. It's 77 or 78 years ago at this point, but so many of them had these time periods where they just simply can't remember because the battle was so horrific. And day in, day out, day or night, there was no getting away from the battle because the island was so small. It was well within artillery range from both sides. And then the Japanese would usually attack at night, which meant that nobody could sleep, and it was just a disaster of a situation. So very, very common when talking to those guys to hear them talk about how they just simply can't remember certain periods of time. And you'll see in part two, that's also the case with Mr. Frederick. I want to thank everybody for listening. Thank you so much for following our podcast. I've had the opportunity to talk to some amazing folks who have emailed me and written and corresponded online. So thank you for that. If you'd like to send us a message, please feel free. Email us walkamongheroes@gmail.com. If you'd like to follow us online, you go to our website, www.walkamongheroes.org. Like to check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/walkamongheroes, Instagram, @walkamongheroes, and you can find us on YouTube and other places. Very, very thankful for your support. We're thankful for all who have checked into Wish for Our Heroes, which is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization that we support that helps military families with basic needs. If you'd like to check them out, you can catch them at www.wishforourheroes.org. Thank you so much to all those who stand guard, protecting our way of life, our police, our firefighters, all of those here stateside, and then, of course, our military stationed around the world who sacrifice so much for all of us to give us all what we call the greatest privilege in the world, freedom. I want to thank those in the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, Space Force, and everybody else standing guard around the world. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks for sharing Mr. Frederick's story, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.